A high-tension wire fence.
At this moment, and for no apparent reason, Bernard suddenly remembered that he had left the eau de cologne tap in his bathroom wide open and running.
Supplied with current from the Grand Canyon Hydroelectric Station.
Cost me a fortune by the time I get back. With his mind's eye, Bernard saw the needle on the scent meter creeping round and round, ant-like, indefatigably. Quickly telephoned to Helmholtz Watson.
Upwards of 5,000 kilometers of fencing at 60,000 volts.
You don't say so, said Lenina politely, not knowing in the least what the warden had said, but taking her cue from his dramatic pause. When the warden started booming, she had inconspicuously swallowed half a gram of soma, with the result that she could now sit serenely not listening, thinking of nothing at all, but with her large blue eyes fixed on the warden's face in an expression of rapt attention.
To touch the fence is instant death,
pronounced the warden solemnly.
There is no escape from a savage reservation.
The word escape was suggestive.
Perhaps, said Bernard, half rising, we ought to think of going.
The little black needle was scurrying, an insect nibbling through time, eating into his money.
No escape,
repeated the warden, waving him back into his chair, and, as the permit was not yet countersigned, Bernard had no choice but to obey.
Those who are born in the reservation... And remember, my dear young lady,
he added, leering obscenely at Lenina and speaking in an improper whisper,
remember that in the reservation children still are born, yes, actually born, revolting as that may seem.
He hoped that this reference to a shameful subject would make Lenina blush, but she only smiled with simulated intelligence and said,
You don't say so.
Disappointed, the warden began again.
Those, I repeat, who are born in the reservation are destined to die there.
Destined to die. A deciliter of eau de cologne every minute. 6 liters an hour.
Perhaps, Bernard tried again, we ought.
Leaning forward, the director tapped the table with his forefinger.
You ask me how many people live in the reservation, and I reply,
triumphantly,
I reply that we do not know. We can only guess.
You don't say.
My dear young lady, I do say so.
6 times 24. No, it would be nearer 6 times 36. Bernard was pale and trembling with impatience, but... Inexorably, the booming continued.
About 60,000 Indians and half-breeds. Absolute savages. Our inspectors occasionally visit. Otherwise, no communication whatever with the civilized world. Still preserve their repulsive habits and customs. Marriage, if you know what that is, my dear young lady. Families, no conditioning. Monstrous superstitions. Christianity and totemism and ancestor worship. Extinct languages such as Zuni and Spanish and Athapascan. Pumas, porcupines, and other ferocious animals. Infectious diseases. Priests. Venomous lizards.
You don't say so.
They got away at last. Bernard dashed to the telephone. Quick, quick. But it took him nearly 3 minutes to get on to Helmholtz Watson.
We might be among the savages already, he complained. Damned incompetence.
Have a gram, suggested Lenina. He refused, preferring his anger. And at last, thank Ford, he was through. And yes, it was Helmholtz. Helmholtz, to whom he explained what had happened, and who promised to go round at once, and turn off the tap. Yes, at once. But took this opportunity to tell him what the DHC had said in public yesterday evening.
What? He's looking out for someone to take my place?
Bernard's voice was agonized.
So it's actually decided? Did he mention Iceland? You say he did?
Ford, Iceland!
He hung up the receiver and turned back to Lenina. His face was pale, his expression utterly dejected.
"What's the matter?" she asked.
"The matter?" He dropped heavily into a chair. "I'm going to be sent to Iceland." Often in the past he had wondered what it would be like to be subjected, somerless and with nothing but his own inward resources to rely on, to some great trial, some pain, some persecution. He had even longed for affliction. As recently as a week ago, in the director's office, he had imagined himself courageously resisting, stoically accepting suffering without a word. The director's threats had actually elated him, made him feel larger than life. But that, as he now realized, was because he had not taken the threats quite seriously. He had not believed that, when it came to the point, the DHC would ever do anything. Now that it looked as though the threats were really to be fulfilled, Bernard was appalled. Of that imagined stoicism, that theoretical courage, not a trace was left. He raged against himself. What a fool! Against the director. How unfair not to give him that other chance which, he now had no doubt at all, he had always intended to take. And Iceland. Iceland? Lenina shook her head. "Was and will make me ill," she quoted. "I take a gram and only am." In the end, she persuaded him to swallow 4 tablets of soma. 5 minutes later, roots and fruits were abolished. The flower of the present rosily blossomed. A message from the porter announced that, at the warden's orders, a reservation guard had come round with a plane and was waiting on the roof of the hotel. They went up at once. An octoroon in gamma-green uniform saluted and proceeded to recite the morning's program. A bird's-eye view of 10 or 12 of the principal pueblos, then a landing for lunch in the valley of Malpas. The rest house was comfortable there, and up at the pueblo, the savages would probably be celebrating their summer festival. It would be the best place to spend the night. They took their seats in the plane and set off. 10 minutes later, they were crossing the frontier that separated civilization from savagery. Uphill and down, across the deserts of salt or sand, through forests, into the violet depth of canyons, over crag and peak and tabletop mesa, the fence marched on and on, irresistibly the straight line, the geometrical symbol of triumphant human purpose. And at its foot, here and there, a mosaic of white bones, a still unrotted carcass dark on the tawny ground, marked the place where deer or steer, puma or porcupine or coyote, or the greedy turkey buzzards drawn down by the whiff of carrion and fulminated as though by a poetic justice, had come too close to the destroying wires. "They never learn," said the green uniform pilot, pointing down at the skeletons on the ground below them. "And they never will learn," he added, and laughed, as though he had somehow scored a personal triumph over the electrocuted animals. Bernard also laughed. After 2 grams of soma, the joke seemed for some reason good, laughed, and then, almost immediately, dropped off to sleep, and sleeping was carried over Taos and Tisuki, over Nambe and Picoris and Pohaki, over Sia and Cochiti, over Laguna and Acoma and the Enchanted Mesa, over Zuni and Cibola and Ojo Caliente, and woke at last to find the machine standing on the ground, Lenina carrying the suitcases into a small square house, and the gamma-green octoroon talking incomprehensibly with a young Indian.
"Malpas," explained the pilot, as Bernard stepped out. "This is the rest house, and there's a dance this afternoon at the pueblo. He'll take you there." He pointed to the sullen young savage. "Funny, I expect," he grinned. "Everything they do is funny." And with that he climbed into the plane and started up the engines. "Back tomorrow. And remember," he added reassuringly to Lenina, "they're perfectly tame. Savages won't do you any harm. They've got enough experience of gas bombs to know they mustn't play any tricks. Still laughing, he threw the helicopter screws into gear, accelerated, and was gone. Chapter 7. The Mesa was like a ship becalmed in a strait of lion-colored dust. The channel wound between precipitous banks, and slanting from one wall to the other across the valley, ran a streak of green, the river and its fields. On the prow of that stone ship in the center of the strait, and seemingly a part of it, a shaped and geometrical outcrop of the naked rock, stood the pueblo of Malpais. Block above block, each story smaller than the one below, the tall houses rose like stepped and amputated pyramids into the blue sky. At their feet lay a straggle of low buildings, a crisscross of walls, and on three sides the precipices fell sheer into the plain. A few columns of smoke mounted perpendicularly into the windless air and were lost. "Queer," said Lenina. "Very queer." It was an ordinary word of condemnation. "I don't like it, and I don't like that man." She pointed to the Indian guide, who had been appointed to take them up to the pueblo. Her feeling was evidently reciprocated. The very back of the man, as he walked along before them, was hostile, sullenly contemptuous. "Besides," she lowered her voice, "he smells." Bernard did not attempt to deny it. They walked on. Suddenly, it was as though the whole air had come alive and were pulsing, pulsing with the indefatigable movement of blood. Up there, in Malpais, the drums were being beaten. Their feet fell in with the rhythm of that mysterious heart. They quickened their pace. Their path led them to the foot of the precipice. The sides of the great Mesa ship towered over them 300 feet to the gunwale. "I wish we could have brought the plane," said Lenina, looking up resentfully at the blank impending rock face. "I hate walking, and you feel so small when you're on the ground at the bottom of a hill." They walked along for some way in the shadow of the mesa, rounded a projection, and there, in a water-worn ravine, was the way up the companion ladder. They climbed. It was a very steep path that zigzagged from side to side of the gully. Sometimes the pulsing of the drums was all but inaudible. At others, they seemed to be beating only just round the corner. When they were halfway up, an eagle flew past so close to them that the wind of his wings blew chill on their faces. In a crevice of the rock lay a pile of bones. It was all oppressively queer, and the Indians smelt stronger and stronger. They emerged at last from the ravine into the full sunlight. The top of the mesa was a flat deck of stone. "Like the Charing Tea Tower," was Lenina's comment. But she was not allowed to enjoy her discovery of this reassuring resemblance for long. A padding of soft feet made them turn round. Naked from throat to navel, their dark brown bodies painted with white lines. "Like asphalt tennis courts," Lenina was later to explain. Their faces inhuman with daubings of scarlet, black, and ochre, two Indians came running along the path. Their black hair was braided with fox fur and red flannel. Cloaks of turkey feathers fluttered from their shoulders. Huge feather diadems exploded gaudily around their heads. With every step they took came the clink and rattle of their silver bracelets, their heavy necklaces of bone and turquoise beads. They came on without a word, running quietly in their deerskin moccasins. One of them was holding a feather brush. The other carried, in either hand, what looked at a distance like 3 or 4 pieces of thick rope. One of the ropes writhed uneasily, and suddenly Lenina saw that they were snakes. The men came nearer and nearer. Their dark eyes looked at her, but without giving any sign of recognition, any smallest sign that they had seen her or were aware of her existence. The writhing snake hung limp again with the rest. The men passed. "I don't like it," said Lenina. "I don't like it." She liked even less what awaited her at the entrance to the pueblo, where their guide had left them while he went inside for instructions. The dirt, to start with, the piles of rubbish, the
dust, the dogs, the flies. Her face wrinkled up into a grimace of disgust. She held her handkerchief to her nose. "But how can they live like this?" she broke out in a voice of indignant incredulity. "It wasn't possible." Bernard shrugged his shoulders philosophically. "Anyhow," he said, "they've been doing it for at least 5,000 or 6,000 years, so I suppose they must be used to it by now." "But cleanliness is next to fraudliness," she insisted. "Yes, and civilization is sterilization," Bernard went on, concluding on a tone of irony the second hypnopedic lesson in elementary hygiene. "But these people have never heard of our Ford, and they aren't civilized, so there's no point in..." "Oh!" she gripped his arm. "Look!" An almost naked Indian was very slowly climbing down the ladder from the first floor terrace of a neighboring house, rung after rung, with the tremulous caution of extreme old age. His face was profoundly wrinkled and black, like a mask of obsidian. The toothless mouth had fallen in. At the corners of the lips and on each side of the chin, a few long bristles gleamed almost white against the dark skin. The long, unbraided hair hung down in grey wisps round his face. His body was bent and emaciated to the bone, almost fleshless. Very slowly he came down, pausing at each rung before he ventured another step. "What's the matter with him?" whispered Lenina. Her eyes were wide with horror and amazement. "He's old, that's all," Bernard answered as carelessly as he could. He too was startled, but he made an effort to seem unmoved. "Old?" she repeated. "But the director's old. Lots of people are old. They're not like that." "That's because we don't allow them to be like that. We preserve them from diseases. We keep their internal secretions artificially balanced at a youthful equilibrium. We don't permit their magnesium-calcium ratio to fall below what it was at 30. We give them transfusions of young blood. We keep their metabolism permanently stimulated. So of course they don't look like that. Partly," he added, "because most of them die long before they reach this old creature's age. Youth almost unimpaired till 60, and then crack, the end." But Lenina was not listening. She was watching the old man. Slowly, slowly, he came down. His feet touched the ground. He turned. In their deep sunken orbits, his eyes were still extraordinarily bright. They looked at her for a long moment, expressionlessly, without surprise, as though she had not been there at all. Then slowly, with bent back, the old man hobbled past them and was gone. "But it's terrible," Lenina whispered. "It's awful. We ought not have come here." She felt in her pocket for her soma, only to discover that by some unprecedented oversight she had left the bottle down at the rest house. Bernard's pockets were also empty. Lenina was left to face the horrors of Malpace unaided. They came crowding in on her, thick and fast. The spectacle of two young women giving the breast to their babies made her blush and turn away her face. She had never seen anything so indecent in her life. And what made it worse was that, instead of tactfully ignoring it, Bernard proceeded to make open comments on this revoltingly viviparous scene. Ashamed, now that the effects of the soma had worn off, of the weakness he had displayed that morning in the hotel, he went out of his way to show himself strong and unorthodox. "What a wonderfully intimate relationship!" he said, deliberately outrageous. "And what an intensity of feeling it must generate! I often think one must have missed something in not having had a mother. And perhaps you've missed something in not being a mother, Lenina. Imagine yourself sitting there with a little baby of your own. Bernard, how can you?" The passage of an old woman with ophthalmia and a disease of the skin distracted her from her indignation. "Let's go away," she begged. "I don't like it." But at this moment their guide came back, and, beckoning them to follow, led the way down the narrow street between the houses. They rounded a corner. A dead dog was lying on a rubbish heap. A woman with a goiter was looking for lice in the hair of a small girl. Their guide halted at the foot of a ladder, raised his hand perpendicularly, then darted it horizontally forward. They did what he mutely commanded. climbed the ladder, and walked through the doorway, to which it gave access into a long, narrow room.